Gene Gilman joins me for a look at the history of state-sponsored bioweapons programs and contemporary bioterrorism. She's a professor of sociology at Boston College, a senior fellow at MIT's Security Studies Program, and the author of a new book called Biological Weapons, published by Columbia University Press. Professor Gilman, very pleased to welcome you to my show.
Thank you.
How long have there been state-sponsored biological weapons programs? Is there any record of the first one?
Well, the whole 20th century from the very beginning was devoted to biological weapons programs. All the major military powers, with one exception, one very important exception, which was Germany in the 1930s, invested greatly in these programs, which were targeted against enemy civilians.
So Hitler was the only person who didn't think they were a good idea?
Well, it's an interesting story of Hitler, for reasons of personal aversion, deciding that he didn't want a biological weapons program. He had the scientists on hand who very much wanted to have one, and he had the rest of the world, the French and the British and the Americans, completely terrified and convinced that he did have a biological weapons program, which is part of the reason why they built up their biological weapons programs.
Well, there are rumors that the biological weapons have been used for a long time, that they were used to wipe out many of the indigenous people of the Americas, although there are others who argue that that's not true. Would that have been biological warfare?
Well, my approach is to emphasize the state programs, the really dangerous ones, not just a particular agent like smallpox and its use, which did happen in the 18th century against
Indian. But then smallpox becomes part of a Soviet program later, so smallpox is one of the biological weapons.
It's an agent. It's a disease agent. The virus is called a disease agent. But we've always had disease around. What we had starting in the 20th century was the use of disease to target civilians.
And how different is the use of disease from the use of chemical weapons in that regard? I would think that disease is a lot harder to control.
Much harder to control. Chemical weapons were the first real effort that the states made, and this was in the late 19th and early 20th century, to take a rather advanced science, chemistry, and which also had a big industrial base, and then use it for military purposes. So there are a lot of similarities between the way in which states develop chemical weapons programs and then moved from chemical weapons right over to biological.
Would we know everything that's happened? This is the sort of thing that people tend to put under top secret stamps.
Well, the striking thing about the history of biological weapons is that there's secrecy and misinformation and disinformation at every turn. It was very difficult to put together the information I was able to put together for this book because even today, the states, including France, for example, but also Israel, I think various sectors of the former Soviet Union, all of these things are kept secret still.
The Geneva Conventions did not address them, did they?
Well, we had a law, 1925 Geneva Protocol, which forbade the use of chemical and biological weapons. That was just the use that it forbade. But it didn't.
That was as a result of what had happened in World War I with the mustard gas.
Yes, with the incredible use of chemicals in World War I, incredible acceleration. Every compound you could imagine, not just mustard, but every chemical compound you could imagine was used and used by all sides in World War I.
And then because it said you can't employ them but didn't say anything about developing them, countries felt that they had free rein to continue the research. To what end?
Well, that's
if you can't use them.
Yeah, and not only that, but you could say you keep them so secret you can't even scare your enemy with them. And that, so it does become rather confounding. And one of the things I found consistently through all the programs was that they would sometimes be secret within the state itself, and even within the military, that some heads of government, for example, would not really be cognizant of what was going on in a biological weapons program. And some of them just grew like topsy. They just proliferated and got larger and larger without really accomplishing anything. And by the way, I think it's important for people to know that biological weapons never have been used in war except by the Japanese against the Chinese in the 1930s and 40s.
Although there is a book that suggests that the United States attempted to use them, against China during the Korean War, when we dropped feathers that had been infected with biological agents and some other stuff that was supposed to float across the Chinese countryside. It turned out not to be all that effective.
Well, we're not even sure it's all true. There's a famous report called the Needham Report, which tried to bring together all of this information. And I think today there's still tremendous ambiguity about that. It's one of the things about biological weapons is it's very hard to know whether it's naturally caused or whether it's intentionally caused. And that being said, we have a lot more problems with what we would call the naturally caused epidemics. And very few instances of intentional, deliberate epidemics.
There's also the speculation about yellow rain in Southeast Asia, which the Soviet Union was accused of using biological weapons.
That's right, of assisting Vietnam and Laos in persecuting the Hmong tribespeople. Mm-hmm. I was involved in some of that research, and I don't think there was much substance to that allegation. But it does point to the secrecy, again, the state secrecy issue over and over coming back. How could we know what the Soviet Union was doing? And there's also something about the ambiguity around disease itself, which makes it just a really fertile ground for, again, misinformation, disinformation, allegations.
So how do you research a book like this if so much of it is still secret?
Well, other people have done good work, and I've drawn on that. You have to go to different archives, which I did, too. We have more openness now. Certainly the United Kingdom archives are almost completely open now for their program. The United States has done a wonderful job in terms of its archiving. A lot of things are out there and available for people to go and look at. But my goal was to get it all in one book so that if you had a question about biological weapons, you'd have that one source book. You could go to it, and you could find out, and if you read my footnotes, you could even find out where you could go if you want to find out more.
There was a biological weapons convention convened. What led to that?
Well, in 1969, President Richard Nixon renounced with the stroke of a pen the United States biological weapons program. He just decided he was going to eliminate that entire category of weapons, almost unique in history that a head of state would do it.
Because unilateral banning of any kind of weapon system is rare.
Yes. I mean, to dismantle an entire weapons program and say, we're not going to do this anymore is very unusual.
Did we actually dismantle it?
Yeah, we did indeed. Yes, they went and they destroyed anthrax stores and plague stores, and they destroyed buildings, and they did a very good job, and they videotaped it, or they filmed it. Actually, at that time, they filmed it.
And
so this
other countries
led up.
Well,
other countries were very heartened by this. The United Kingdom had already, by 1969, pretty much ended its offensive program. The French had pulled out. These were countries, by the way, that had big programs, but once they got nuclear weapons, they felt they didn't need the biological weapons anymore. And the biological weapons are technically troubling. There's a moral norm against them, but in addition to that, it's very hard to control air and aerosols, and you really don't know what the impact of exposure is going to be.
I want to follow that a bit more in just a moment. My guest is Jean Guilleman, G-U-I-L-L-E-M-I-N. Her book, Biological Weapons, From the Invention of State-Sponsored Programs to Contemporary Bioterrorism. It is published by Columbia University Press. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820, or online at WNYC.org. So is part of the problem that they're just hard to deliver? If they were more effective and more efficient, if you could be sure that they wouldn't also come back and kill your own people, would there still be more systems being worked on today?
Well, I think you have this norm against them, which most states in the world right now adhere to the treaty and seem to be on board with that. We mentioned before, by the way, the Biological Weapons Convention, and I should just follow through from the Nixon decision. You go from the Nixon decision in 1969 to nations of the world coming together and creating the Biological Weapons Convention in 1972. And that convention forbids the programs. The Geneva Protocol forbids the use. That's 1925. But 1972, you have now an international treaty that says you can't build those factories for mass producing anthrax or plague. You can't even have the machinery that you were going to put on planes for spray generators or for bombs. That will be now be illegal in the world.
And did everyone sign on to that?
Everyone signed on. Not everyone adhered. Not everyone followed the rule, the Soviet Union being the great exception, South Africa being another exception. The Soviet Union case, I think, is one of the great and most troubling, I think, of the century. They were able to build an enormous program after signing that treaty in 1975. And they did it because they were so secret, because it was a totalitarian state. You couldn't get in there. You couldn't see anything. You couldn't verify anything.
But it came back to haunt them, didn't it? Because they had two outbreaks that killed their own people.
That's right.
It was a smallpox outbreak before they signed the treaty.
That
and then
was just
the
before,
anthrax
yeah.
afterward.
That's right. Both terrible events. And again, going to this issue of civilian vulnerability. Civilians are very vulnerable to this kind of weapon. And again, the programs were within the line of total war doctrine. The idea was to make biological weapons to attack enemy civilians, not for use on the battlefield. Because as you mentioned, the stuff blows around. It's really it's dangerous for you as it might be for your enemy. But for the mass destruction of people in a city, in an industrial center, well, there was a certain allure to biological weapons when you approach that vision, and people would argue and advocate for that vision. We could destroy an entire city.
Is that how the Japanese had used it?
The Japanese program never got above a level of a technologically crude level. The Japanese, for example, used plague-infected fleas to spread plague among people in Chinese towns and cities in the early 1940s. This was done by sabotage and by some dropping of fleas, packages of fleas from planes, things like that.
Well, then how do you bring your soldiers in afterward if there's a plague?
Well, I think that it wasn't very well thought through, if we could put it that way. And, the Japanese military at the higher levels never assimilated this kind of weapon. This was one of these things you do in the heat of war. It's called inadvertent escalation. It's when you've tried everything else, but now what do we have in the arsenal? Let's try that. And I think the Japanese went in that direction, being totally out of control and not thinking of your very good point. What if we go in there and there are plague-infected rats around and we get it?
Well, why did the South Africans pursue this? Wouldn't the same problem occur there?
The South Africans also had a technically limited program, but they had great intent. You have to remember apartheid South Africa in the 70s and up through the early 1990s was in a desperate state. It was the last white hegemony in South Africa, and they were desperate. They had insurgents from within, and they had rebels from without. They were in very bad straits, and I think there's a kind of dire threat issue that you see whenever biological weapons programs arise. The idea that the nation will be destroyed if we don't have this in our arsenal, we won't have a kind of ultimate weapon to fight back with, and that was the South African approach. We're desperate, and we're not going to survive.
And if we don't do it, our enemy is going to do it.
And our enemies will do it. Or
that's always the argument used in almost any escalation, isn't it?
It's true. And with disease weapons, it's particularly difficult because you pioneer a more virulent kind of anthrax or plague, and then you have to live with that.
Well, we're talking about countries that on the whole felt like they were isolated from the rest of the world, had a kind of fortress mentality. The country that seems most like that today is North Korea. But has anyone,
or Israel, by the way.
Well, Israel, again, feeling like it's a fortress. But also, I can't see how biological weapons would work with Israel. It's in such a small area. Again, wouldn't the bounce back be really destructive?
Well, there are certain...
Can these things be very
There are certain
controlled?
Diseases that are... there are infectious diseases, and then there are infectious diseases that are contagious. So if you have an infectious disease like anthrax, but it's not contagious person to person, then you have a weapon that maybe has a use or possibly could have a use without the bounce back that you're talking about.
And we saw that with the anthrax scare in this country. It was targeted at specific people. Others got hurt along the way, but it didn't spread to the whole population.
Well, the terrible thing about anthrax is that it contaminates everything everywhere it goes. So we're still cleaning up post offices and we're still worried about anthrax contamination everywhere. So, again, you know, these are bad inventions that we live with right now.
That was the subject of your previous book, Anthrax, the Investigation of a Deadly Outbreak. And it's never been resolved, has it? We don't know who sent those letters.
We don't know who sent the letters. And again, this goes to secrecy in government. I think we would have progressed much better with that criminal investigation if the different governments involved and also within our government had been much more forthcoming and had not been more guarded. They were guarded about their secrets relating to intelligence and defense projects.
So they may very well know who sent the letters but can't reveal it because it would then lead to all sorts of other information becoming available?
Of course. This is you're in the realm now of classified information, and once you have classified information, public inquiry really stops.
But if we're no longer involved in a biological weapons program, what's the difference?
What do you mean, what's the difference?
Well, if the United States is no longer dabbling in this sort of thing, then why would we even care? Shouldn't we have become totally open about all of this since 1969 when Richard Nixon signed that presidential directive?
Well, we did go through a period of great openness, but I think in the post-Cold War years, we've become invested in biodefense, being defensive about what terrorists might do in particular or what rogue states might do. And so we have developed layers now of secrecy around research on select agents, on anthrax and plague and tularemia and other agents.
And when those letters were sent, a number of people suggested that they were that whoever did it was aided by some foreign government. In fact, anthrax was one of the issues when we were talking about going to war with Saddam Hussein. Do you think there are many countries that where these kinds of programs are being carried on in secrecy?
Well, This is the question, and it's the most important question I think we have facing us, is what is going on in the different states. Now, one of the things that history shows us, by the way, is that you can have democracies, monarchies, you can have totalitarian governments, you can have fascist states of any sort that develop biological weapons. And we had, for example, apartheid. South Africa was nominally a democracy. We have Israel, a democracy. I think we have to have everybody step up and be more open about what's going on within the state governments. But we have no mechanism now for that kind of transparency, and we need it very badly.
But then we also have enemies who are not states, Osama bin Laden, al-Qaeda. Let's take a little break. When we come back, we'll talk about that and whether there are groups out there that can put together biological weapons as a way of creating terror. My guest is Gene Gilliman, whose book, Biological Weapons, From the Invention of State-Sponsored Programs to Contemporary Bioterrorism, is published by Columbia University Press. We're back with Gene Gilliman, professor of sociology at Boston College and senior fellow in the Security Studies Program at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Previous book, Anthrax, the Investigation of a Deadly Outbreak. Now, Biological Weapons, From the Invention of State-Sponsored Programs to Contemporary Bioterrorism, from Columbia University Press. So how does a sociologist wind up writing about biological weapons?
Well, my background originally was studying medical technology, high-end medical technology, but little by little I got interested in epidemics, and then in 1992 I was part of a team that went to the former Soviet Union, and we investigated the largest outbreak of inhalational anthrax in history and discovered that it had come from a military facility, that an aerosol from a military facility had killed some 70 people.
When we talked about that the last time you were here, I remember that you said that the biggest problem with anthrax and many other biological weapons is the delivery systems. It's very difficult to spread it. in the way that chemical weapons could be spread. We all we have to do is think back to the Shinrikyo nerve gas attack of sarin in the Tokyo subway and realize that chemicals can be very effective. Much more difficult with biological weapons?
Well, biological weapons have become of great interest to us now in a way because we think about bioterrorism a lot, and this word bioterrorism appears around 1990. And we've become very fixated on the idea that there will be terrorists who, with minimal technology, can have a mass impact.
But I remember back in the 60s and 70s, people used to talk about the possibility that somebody's going to drop a lot of LSD in the water supply. And then it was pointed out that it would take enormous amounts to have any effect.
Yes, I think that's a very good analogy. We've really passed into a kind of epoch of paranoia in this country. And I think we're being very distracted from the real threats. We have real threats with infectious diseases, not only within this country, but internationally. If you just look at AIDS and malaria and sleeping sickness and cholera.
And avian flus.
Emerging infectious diseases. These are real threats that we must pay attention to. And I think bioterrorism, although it has had some fairly good effects in terms of improving surveillance of disease, for example, it's not really yielded for the money that's been put in. It's not really yielded better protection. And again, we're failing badly to implement the Biological Weapons Convention so that other states want to show us that they're not doing bad things with their pharmaceutical companies or with their emerging technologies in biotechnology. So we're ignoring big threats. We tend to get very preoccupied about, for example, in the lead up to the Iraq invasion, there was tremendous preoccupation at the very highest level of government with Saddam Hussein sending terrorists infected with smallpox and creating some great pandemic here in the United States. And of course, this was, just to put it bluntly, it was nonsense.
Well, what would have happened if somebody who had been infected with, or 10 people infected with smallpox, suicide bombers kind of, had come to the United States? How much havoc could they have actually created?
But the first presumption is that there is smallpox virus out there to be had. That's a very big presumption right now. We have two reserves of it.
Yeah, there was the talk of destroying the last one in the Soviet Union, and that didn't happen.
Or here, we have one in Atlanta, reserves in Atlanta of smallpox strains. It's a pity we haven't destroyed it all. We really just should get rid of it. But we do have these two reserves, one in Russia and one here. And as far as anybody can tell, the security around them is very good. And we haven't, and all of the scare talk about Saddam Hussein having smallpox was just a way of manipulating the American public.
What about bubonic plague or something else that isn't isolated to two places in the world?
Sure, there are diseases around. It's possible that diseases happen. But the idea of somebody intentionally getting hold of it and then intentionally creating a massive pandemic is a little bit in the science fiction realm.
Well, actually, it's the sort of thing that we've been hearing about AIDS, isn't it? There are some people who believe that AIDS was created to destroy Africans.
That's right, yes, yes.
The whole idea. That's one of the accusations.
But disease has so much ambiguity in it that it lends itself to these kind of imaginations. And the public can get very exploited by fear about disease. And we did in this country. In 2003, the United States began a campaign to vaccinate all Americans against smallpox. And it was purely an artifact of going into Iraq,
where there was no indication that any smallpox existed.
There was no indication. There was no intelligence.
But do you think that was just simply a way for the government to mobilize public sentiment against Iraq,
or do you think
that there was a real fear?
The fear was real on the part of people who wanted that invasion. Vice President Cheney was the main advocate for vaccinating all Americans against smallpox. He saw a tabletop exercise called Dark Winter, which was afterwards roundly criticized by people who know a lot about smallpox as a complete fabrication of risk. And Vice President Cheney saw this tabletop exercise and went directly to the National Security Council and the president and said, we've got to vaccinate Americans against smallpox.
Okay, so it didn't happen, and we've discovered that Iraq didn't have any of the weapons that we were told it had. But if I were a terrorist right now, and I were trying to find an inexpensive way to cause real problems throughout the world, other than bombing subway systems, would biological weapons be a possibility?
Why other than bombing? The bombings are doing just fine. I don't know of any terrorists who are walking around disappointed about bombings. They've used them to tremendous dramatic effect. They've used them viciously.
But a biological weapon would last longer. Once I get it going, people would see the effects for months, maybe even years to follow.
Or maybe nothing at all would happen. We really don't know about disease transmission, effective disease transmission in the intentional sense. There's not that much information about it in just even, you know, why one person would get an infectious disease and why another wouldn't. And by the way, the effect, of course, would be delayed. You really wouldn't know what the source was. And again, if we go back to the battleground scenarios, the terrorists could come down with it themselves.
As I said earlier, but they do have a psychological impact. They would provoke the kind of fear that a one-time bombing might not provoke. And if you want to create panic get your enemy to be totally panicked, I can't think of a better way of going about it. On the other hand, they could probably develop chemical weapons and have the same impact, couldn't they?
No, chemical weapons are, number one, difficult. And
sarin was pretty effective in Tokyo, wasn't it?
Well, sarin, it depends on what you think is effective, but it killed relatively few people, injured maybe some hundreds more. But these are scenarios that we have not seen played out with any vigor by any terrorists, and I certainly hope that we don't. But again... we're in the realm of imagination, and I think you can go down a very dangerous route when you alarm the public about the diseases it can catch because some foreigners are going to invade the country. We've never had an epidemic in this country, by the way, of any size, that somebody didn't turn around and blame foreigners for it. So I think we're seeing that with the bioterrorism scenarios. It's always the foreigners coming in, and they're going to infect you with lethal diseases. I think we have to back off from that and ask ourselves, what are the real threats to American public health?
And whether we can deal with them with duct tape and plastic sheets.
Or whether there are technological fixes. We have a really rather weak, to put it mildly, public health infrastructure where if you remember from last fall, people couldn't get their influenza shots. That's a sad comment on American public health. So even if there were a problem with bioterrorism, the best thing we could do is to have a strong public health infrastructure so people know where to go. They have trusted caregivers. They know how to choose from one antibiotic to another or one vaccine to another. So they are informed. But we have a lot of work to do in that direction.
There was also a big controversy over the anthrax serum. Some people were claiming it was making them sick when there was no need to even take it.
This centered a lot in the U.S. military because under the Clinton administration, there was a program to vaccinate everyone against anthrax who was in the military, 2.5 million people. And that didn't go too well because there were people who protested that they had very serious side effects and they were worried about long-term side effects from the anthrax vaccine. And indeed, the courts have supported the position that the vaccine may indeed be threatening to people.
And you seem to be suggesting that it doesn't matter either way because it's a ridiculous thing to worry about.
It's not a ridiculous thing to worry about, but you want to keep things in proportion. Since 2001, we've spent something like $25 billion on biodefense in this country. I think we need to ask, was that well spent and what have we gotten for it? Should we have been putting that money into fortification of the Biological Weapons Convention? Should we have been putting it into basic public health? Of course. Those would have been the two really sensible ways of using that money. But we've gotten a bit into an extravagant mode here with biodefense.
To some degree because of what happened on September 11th?
Absolutely. September 11th and the anthrax letters that followed soon after put us into a fright mode. But I think it's time for us to get out of the fright mode and get into a more rational and proportional approach to what are the threats of disease.
And is that your intention with this book, to tell us that biological weapons were used in the past. They were relatively ineffective. Even Adolf Hitler didn't think they were a good idea. And there's little to worry about from them, while there are other real serious medical issues that we should be concerning ourselves with.
Well, the main message in my book is that secrecy is life-threatening.
Mm-hmm.
That if you want to cause more deaths, or if you want to destabilize a society with disease threats, and if you want to really put people in great jeopardy, then create secret institutions and secret programs and layers of secrecy around the issue of disease, and you will get the terrible outcome. All of these programs were sustained and became very large because of secrecy, because the public didn't know. See, the public knew that we, for example, in this country, had a nuclear program. They knew we had a chemical program. Most people during the course of the U.S. program had not a clue about what was going on with the American Biological Weapons Program, and that included members of Congress. Most members of Congress didn't know anything about what was going on, and that's a very dangerous situation. So my message is secrecy is life-threatening.
Were there any outbreaks of the sort that the Soviets went through? I think it was in Vladivostok, wasn't it?
Down near it was near the Aral Sea, right, and it was a small outbreak of smallpox. That was the first one, I think, that we know about, and that was only recently admitted to. And then the other one was the anthrax epidemic in 1979. Yes. We've never had anything on that level. When we had an offensive program, we didn't see anything. But there's great fear now around what we call the biosafety level 4 laboratories, which are going to be researching and probably pioneering some new kinds of, let's say, anthrax or smallpox agents. And I think
like
that
the one out in Long Island? Or
yes, we
Island?
Have that. You have a level, of course, we have one down in Atlanta, but there are plans to build a level 4 lab up in Boston, which is now the center of a controversy. People in the local community are afraid of accidents like the one that happened at Sverdlovsk. The level 4 lab in Boston, for example, would be investigating aerosols of select agents. It's a very dangerous venture, aerosolization of select agents. And so suppose an aerosol is released, suppose a ventilation system goes wrong, the local community, as in Sverdlovsk, would be the target, if you will.
Wasn't Legionnaire's disease the sort of thing that a bioterrorist would actually love to be able to harness?
Oh, I don't think so. It's a lot more fragile. When you talk about these weapons agents like anthrax and tularemian plague, these were all developed to be sturdy, hardy, virulent entities suitable for standard weapons. So you're in another realm. You're not in the ordinary realm of other infectious diseases. You could, I suppose, take any disease and work on it. But the selection, we call them select agents because they were selected because they'd be good for weapons.
And you say that we're still cleaning up some of our post offices?
I think that's a process that every once in a while you hear about. It took there were 24 different postal facilities that were contaminated by those letters. And just as a story on irony, I went back to Sverdlovsk, the now called Ekaterinburg, the year before last, and the public health people there told me that the State Department had sent them inadvertently letters that were cross-contaminated by anthrax coming out of Washington, D.C., and that the same public health people that worked to discover anthrax in 1979, some of them still working there, were helping the consulate in Ekaterinburg to find out what strain of anthrax now was in the mailbag. So, again, anthrax goes on and on.
Is it easily detected?
Oh, yes, it's easy enough to detect, sure.
So have we learned anything from this? Are postal workers any better protected than they were in October 2001?
Well, I think there's a great struggle going on now. I have been working with the Brentwood postal workers down in Washington, D.C., mainly an African-American group. And these were the people who were not advised in a timely way that they were exposed to anthrax and not given antibiotics on time and not even told what the symptoms of anthrax might be so that they could have reported them in a good fashion. And they lost two of their people died and several others became ill. Are we safe? I don't think they particularly feel safer, although the post office struggles mightily with its sensors and with trying to keep things cleaner and better than they were before.
When I talked about the animal research lab off of Long Island some years back, many people scoffed and said that we were just talking about some trying to frighten people. Is that a reasonable concern?
I think it's a reasonable concern if you don't, again, have the kind of transparency and oversight that's necessary for accountability to the public. There shouldn't be anything going on in the study of these kinds of diseases that is not reportable back to the public, and that could be the local community, that could be the state. In Massachusetts, by the way, we're working on a law, be the first in the country, which would demand oversight from a BSL-4, BSL-3 lab so that the public knows what agents they're working on and what the level of risk is. We have to know that because it's the public that really is vulnerable.
And the government has paid the price in the past with people who've come down with problems because of nuclear testing, secret, with chemical spills and the like. You'd think that by now someone would have learned that that Pennywise turns out to be pound foolish in the long run. My guest is Jean Gilliman. Her book, Biological Weapons, From the Invention of State-Sponsored Programs to Contemporary Bioterrorism, it's from Columbia University Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.